Technicians of Spaceship Earth, welcome to the end of Hawk Binge, Season 2. Before we embark on Season 3 and Hawkwind in the 90s, we wanted to look back on what made Hawkwind so great in the 80s by reliving our thoughts on the tracks that made it to the master playlist this season.
And seeing as this is the last time we'll get to Andy, I thought maybe we'd give that game a try that you found in the 1988 Hawkwind program that we scanned and added to our podcast archive.
Classic. Love that idea. And I see you've got the board all laid out, well prepared. Which piece do you want to be?
I think I'm going to be the head in the jar.
I've always seen you as a head in a jar. I think I shall be the stealer of souls, the black sword. Do you want to start?
Yeah, perfect. Okay, so here I go. That's a 4. And 1, 2, 3, 4. My square says, Ginger Baker calls you the worst musician in the world. Go back to the start. That's a good start for me.
Nice. Well, while you're doing that, there's time to listen to Ginger Baker and everyone he fell out with and get our reaction to the first record that you chose for the Master Playlist from the 80s, which was Space Chase from Levitation. Bit of a tone change now as we go into a track which in football terms would be what happens when you give the ball to the Galacticos and just watch them play. This is the crazed freakout that is Space Chase, which apparently is the track that Simon King just couldn't get to grips with in the state that he was in at the time. And Ginger Baker just sat down and nailed.
I can see why. I mean, it's demanding. The first time I heard this track, I didn't know what it was called. And when I looked at my phone, it was called Space Chase. I was like, that is the most appropriate name for this. I love that. It feels like it could be a soundtrack to a chase in a film, or actually because of that bleepy bloopy stuff at the start that sounds like an old arcade game, for the second time in this album, it feels like it could be an arcade game reference. Again, I feel like this is Hawkwind being very musically confident in a way that I haven't ever really heard them be like that before. It's got a riff that just carries the whole track. I feel like some of that special effects kind of like swazzle, like some of the early Hawkwind albums, including the very first one. I feel like that's back a little bit in this, which I really like. And the drums are so good at changing the feel of this. They go from this clattering intensity to suddenly switching up and doing that kick snare, along with the riff, which just then completely changes for a second how you think about the track. And then it's back into the more intense stuff. And again, it's these flares and these touches that just make you feel like Hawkwind have the ability now to explore a musical idea as much as a thought, to go from this spacey weightlessness to deep and intense at a moment's notice, makes this track feel like a real event. Probably more to my taste than Levitation in terms of what they're doing, taking you through that journey, but no less intense. And for me, no less fun. I always finish this track with a big smile on my face, even if Who's Gonna Win the War is trying to wipe it off me. This puts it back on and becomes a very enjoyable track. I feel like Space Chase really knocks out of the park what World of Tears set up a few tracks ago.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a joy to listen to. I particularly love the point in the track where Tim Blake comes in with the big keyboard arpeggiators. It just goes off on one. Mm-hmm. Like, there you go, Tim. Run with that. And it just brings a huge smile. They seem to be having a great time playing this. It's a bit of a joy. As you say, there's not huge amounts to say, really, other than the fact that the playing is just incredible from everybody concerned. And, don't want to sound too critical of Simon King here with this. The man was obviously going through a pretty bad time. What a fantastic servant to Hawkwind he was. But totally, Ginger Baker does something different in Hawkwind. It's not a question of doing what Simon King did and doing it better. It's different to what Simon King did. Simon apparently made one or two attempts to get back into drumming. Didn't really happen. Cleaned his life up. Led a normal life. Was very, very happy. So, good end to the story for him. But I don't feel that this track would be anything like what it is with any other drummer than Ginger Baker playing it. But there is definitely such a joy to both Hugh and Tim's playing in this track. So it's always a big smile to my face whenever this one comes on.
For sure. And I know ages ago we were talking around how Hawkwind reconciled the synth vibe with the rock vibe and how it comes together. When you start to get really great musicians, it almost becomes an eventuality. it just feels like this is somewhere where they should get to. And it's just done so well and so nicely. This feels weirdly, in a way, like more Hawkwind, even though there isn't the story to it. We've heard these instrumentals before, but done in this super intense way. I like the playful name. I just like the fact that this is them going, we're having fun with this. You can have fun with this. Let's all have fun with this. And you feel like, I'm gonna. Thanks.
Yep, exactly. Does the job very well.
So now it's my turn. Let's go. I've rolled a 3. Blaze a nuclear way through space. Go forward 15 spaces. Beginner's luck there. But it does remind me of our pick from Sonic Attack.
When I was first listening to this and wasn't looking at the track listing, I was wondering if Virgin of the World and Angels of Death were actually the same track, and this just was a cut. I think just because of the subject matter as well, the idea of being undead and then being angels of death, I think it makes sense that these two go back to back. There is a uniting theme. But compared to Rocky Paths, which comes in guns blazing in that positive riff loop, Angels of Death dropping into the riff, I think, is really good. I think maybe just because there's a little less of it, but it's just a great riff, great drums coming in. For me, that's a great drop. I love the filtered bass. You hear it, and then it comes down to fill out the bottom end of the track. It sounds a little bit like Hawkwind are channeling Dire Straits or something here. Like, there's something like...
We've just lost half our listeners.
I don't know, but there's something about just the way that they're playing it. Reminds me of a Dire Straits record or something. It just feels different to what they've normally done, and definitely different to what they've been doing thus far. But, you know, like Rocky Paths, they've got this harder rock with pleasing key change thing down pat. It feels really well done. I like this one a lot. But yeah, there's something about the way that the riff is played and put together feels like other bands somehow. Or maybe that's just 80s-ness creeping in, and that's just the reference I have because that was a record that I know my dad had when I was growing up. But there's something about it with a dun 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 dun, and then there's a chord which bangs through every fourth beat. For me, it's evocative of a style, if not another band.
Definitely struggling slightly with the Dire Straits thing, but it's now in my head to sing Angels of Death, but substitute Sultans of Swing, and vice versa. That will probably be something that's quite hard to get out of my head now I've put it in.
Sorry about that.
No worries. It's amusing. So... yeah, can't help thinking that there'll be some opinions. We'll see. You might be very right, I guess, and maybe I don't know Dire Straits very well. So, yeah, it is different. It does feel to me like a straight down the line hard rock song. I do really like Dave's delivery. He's got real bite in the lines when he delivers Angels of Death, and he sounds like he's having a wicked good time belting it out. And it did become something of a live favorite. So yeah, Angels of Death is something, again, I think I've grown into. It wasn't one of my favorite tracks. I liked it well enough, but it felt a little bit like filler when I first heard it. Mm. And it's coming back to it that I appreciate it slightly more for what it is. And yeah, so a good one. Not my favorite still, but definitely something I'm quite happy to hear. And as you say, it's a very strong riff.
Yeah, it was nice to hear Dave. This is the first time we've heard him on the album, apart from, like, you know, saying random words on the previous track. He does do a very good rendition of this. It feels good. I don't know if anyone else would have been able to do this compared to anyone else that they've got. So, yeah, I think that was good. You're right. It is a good hard rock track. I think the solo is a little whatever, but actually the solo being a little bit lackluster gave me a chance to really appreciate what's holding that solo up, which is that big textured full bottom end section, which has lots of tactile strumminess and that very 80s sounding kick and snare rhythm with these really nice clear hi-hats that kind of tick, tick, tick their way through. I really like the detailing in that. For me, that's just some really nice recording and some nice mixing. So I do feel like the texture through the entire audio spectrum of this track is really nicely done. So whatever engineer they had on this track has done a very good job. I feel like this is the second time that Hawkwind have made a song for the fans. Like Sonic Attack, you know, this one talks about space. It's got strange sci-fi themes, callback to Warriors on the Edge of Time, even ideas of urban violence and unrest, just updated for this tougher sound and 80s production. So when I said at the beginning, I feel like this is Hawkwind going back to the fans with an album. This for me is very much that kind of track. Again, I feel like the rhyming's a little basic, you know, while and smile, space and race, dead and lead. It's fine. But again, the music aggressiveness of it isn't asking a lot for the cerebral input. So I feel like I notice it when it's not there, especially when we've started to get interesting things like the poem of Virgin of the World and this idea of psychosomia that I know they can still do it. So I notice it when it's not there, but also this track doesn't particularly warrant it. That said, "We were born to erase all of your days" is a great line. So it makes up for it at the end. Okay, I've recovered from my vicious criticism and I'm ready to roll again. That's a 2. I'm always terrible at these games. Oh, but this square's given me an extra life. Just like our pick for Church of Hawkwind, Andy, it looks like now I'm one of the people who will never die.
Takes us to something quite interesting, though. Some people never die.
This, for me, is the track which saved it the first time I listened to it. We'd had the Star Cannibal, which I'd liked on the first hear, and it was then having to do quite a lot of work to then make up for the next couple of tracks, which it got to. And I was like, this better not be the only blip, because there's been like 4 tracks between that and then this, Some People Never Die, which is almost, I'd say, like, it feels more like art than a track, the way that it's been put together. And I'll try and justify my thinking behind that. I think it's because it sounds like it's performed rather than played. It sounds like someone has this sample of news recording and a band recording and a synth and the effects, and they're all like in some kind of mixer and they're just playing with the faders. You know, it feels more like I can hear someone mixing all these things together in a kind of, not quite music concrete, but more like a DJ or someone who's making a performance of recording stuff, more like a Philip Glass thing or something, compared to it being performed. And I feel that because like the band fades in and then gets really loud and really quiet, as it really feels like someone's like banging on a fader. Same thing with the synth and with the sample. And it's definitely a sample this time. I know this one. I remember seeing the footage when I was doing history back at school, Oswald being shot as he was led out of the police precinct.
Yeah, by Jack Ruby.
Yeah, it's this crazy performance. I think it's great, the fact that the opening of it, it feels like I accidentally skipped to I Feel Love by Donna Summer or something. You know, it's much more like a dancey kind of synth loop, which then kind of bubbles down into this bed that they start to play the samples over. It's interesting that this is on the Fate side, because I was trying to listen to what we have here, which is literally history being recorded and then repeated back to us. And the fact they call it Some People Never Die, again, trying to interpret that title, trying to figure out whether or not it means some people never die because they do things which are historically significant, or is it some people never die because they're now recorded and this is now an age of recorded news, and the fact that you can then take those recordings and those recordings can then be turned into other things like what we're listening to here in this performance. Or is it some people never die and that's either a good or a bad thing because they have Oswald, who obviously shot Kennedy, getting shot.
Or did he?
That is another podcast that I will not get into. Either way, is it the idea of like both good and bad people can get shot, so they become immortal? And does it mean that your actions are different and they both get you to the same place? This kind of immortalness, the idea of you literally died on film, but you also didn't die because the film will be shown again. You know, there's lots to think about. And I feel like Hawkwind have done an interesting thing here, which they cleverly do, which is making me think about all this whilst not actually addressing any of it, apart from presenting it back to me in this musical form. But, you know, I don't mean that in a bad way. I mean that in an interesting way. You know, like the ending of Quark, Strangeness and Charm, you have that music that just makes you think, oh no, the government's about to get these people. And that's all just implied sonically. Same thing with this. I feel like by just playing us back this history with this title and like this music that I'm not quite sure what the music is adding. It's definitely adding something, but it's feeling like the music could almost be seen as a flippant addition, but it's not. I feel like the fact that it's upbeat and a bit raucous, I feel like it might be some kind of commentary on the idea of important parts of history being recorded and reshared in such a strange manner, almost like this becoming a radio play. like that person who's interviewing Kennedy, and then like Kennedy literally gets shot in the head in front of him and he starts narrating what's going on. It seems such a strange thing to do, isn't it? Like normally you just run or scream or something, but he starts narrating it almost like he was expecting it to happen. It's so strange. And then the music just adds this surreality to it where it feels like it could be something out of Blue Jam or something, you know, such an odd Chris Morris performance of something.
That's a good shout. The Blue Jam thing is very evocative of the kind of mood. Yeah, it's a strange one. I used to wonder about the choice of the two events, i.e. Lee Harvey Oswald being shot by Jack Ruby and then Bobby Kennedy being shot. The obvious two things to join together for me would have been JFK and then Lee Harvey Oswald. But then I found out that the exact two same clips are used in a track by a band called On the Seventh Day, who I've never heard of, with a track called They Call Me Gun that I'd never heard of. The tracks are entirely different, but they use these two commentaries and then do something with it. So I wonder whether there was little more thought to it than the fact that Dave heard that and thought, those are two good pieces of commentary, I'll do something with that, which now feels quite likely. I like it, to your point. It fits in that Hawkwind present-day issues-based reality thing. But it sits in the middle of an album which is not that, like a huge brick. So I quite enjoy listening to it. I think it's strong, but it feels strangely out of context with the rest of the album. In a way, it ought to be on Sonic Attack because of its setting. But yeah, it's an interesting one for sure. I do think the musically it is strong. As you say, when you watch documentaries about these things, there will always be a soundtrack. It's not just the soundtrack. It's doing something more than that. But it's quite hard to put your finger on. But yeah, it's a very interesting experiment.
The only thing that I ding it on is the fact that it blows up. It feels like Hawkwind loses faith in the idea and just blows it up and moves on, which is a shame because I would like it to have ended. I guess considering the almost randomness of the whole thing, it blowing up is the least egregious of all of the ones that blow up, but I still don't appreciate it.
Again, it comes back to smacking of that whole R&D vibe to me, where the whole package doesn't feel like it's intended to be the next Hawkwind album. It's the place where they're learning and tinkering and doing things, and therefore they're not too worried about crafting the endings of things, which is interesting how it's ended up being part of the canon as it is. And an interesting album because of that, really, that does bear listening to and some investigation.
My go again. Let's roll. I've rolled a 6. Does that mean I roll again?
I've no idea. There weren't really any rules printed in the program.
Well, in which case, I'm going to take that as meaning that it does mean that I roll again. And a 5, really rocketing across the board here, and I've arrived in Utopia, which was our pick from Choose Your Masks. And like the track, it says that Utopia is so boring, I miss my next turn. Typical.
We go straight back into something with real power and energy and arrive in Utopia.
Yeah, like Choose Your Masks, we are right into the track, aren't we? Which is, again, a bit like the first track. It's instantly groovy. I feel like it's quite a classic rock groove on the drums with a big growly guitar laying down a very animated bottom end and a kind of sparse but very flowing soloish lead at the top, setting this sonic scene for something fun to happen. I feel like as soon as I heard this, I was like, this is going to be fun. You can immediately feel like they're animated and excited about what they've got. There's an immediate vibe and the vocals come in quick to pick up what the music's laid down. And I really like the vocals in this piece. The whole thing is really nicely delivered. There's a great rhythm to the lyrics. You know, it's delivered in this chorus that adds to the energy of the piece. It does sound like there's at least two people singing at the same time, or they've layered it. It's not really like a harmony, but again, it just sounds like a chorus of people, which they've done before and to great effect. And I think the vocals are great in both content and delivery. The theme of dreaming is present, like we just had in the previous track, but this time it's like full on space rock instead of like space ambience. So there's this cryptic, dark ambient piece before, which then explodes out into this piece. I love Days of Wine and Nights of Fire. I think that's a great line. Dogs that talk like boys is a very weird line. So there's a mixture of things that are great and things that are bizarre. But the story itself is really interesting. You know, someone's rejection of the idea of utopia, which is supposed to be the ultimate goal of civilization in theory. And, you know, that is something being seen as boring and pacifying without excitement or danger gives you this bored, mindless lyric that we have, which is, I think, an interesting idea that, you know, while we strive for it, utopia may be something that we should never maybe achieve because it actually ends up being not what we actually want. We want it in theory, but we don't want it in practice. And, you know, it's never really been a core theme of literature or songs, has it? It's more of a point of contrast, you know, like in a film or a story, sometimes if a place is in a state of utopia, it surely won't be. And that will be the drama. It's normally that kind of accident or tragedy that raises the stakes. You know, no one's ever normally singing about everything is great and everything is fine because that wouldn't be an interesting thing.
No, exactly. Or there's some kind of villain behind the scenes and really it's not utopian. So you never get a genuine utopia in which people go, this is horrible, isn't it?
Exactly. Even like, you know, The Matrix goes into that idea where the first version of The Matrix was a utopian fantasy, but we as humans rejected it as viscerally false. So they had to make one like real life, which obviously made the effects budget great because they could just film real life. But I think there's an interesting idea about the fact that the machines tried to give us what we wanted and we actually found we didn't want it.
Yeah.
There's a philosopher called Robert Nozick. I think I'm pronouncing that correctly. But in 1989, he posited this thought experiment called the experience machine, which was this idea of there's a machine and you go into it, either like a needle goes into your head or there's a screen in front of you or however it works in a way that suddenly you're transported into your ideal world that feels completely real. The machine even removes the memory that you even entered the machine. So in your experience, it'll feel so totally real that you can be whatever you want. If you want to fly, you can fly. If you want to be a billionaire, you can be a billionaire. If you want to live on the moon or whatever, you can just do that and it'll feel so real. But he posits at the end of his writing that no one would actually get into the machine, even if it would erase their memory of doing so, precisely because of that reason that people feel like they're betraying their real self. Even if it's an amazing gilded cage, it's still a cage. And so I feel like that's a super deep point that I only read about recently and was only really written about academically in 1989, as far as my cursory research has gone. But, you know, the fact that they're talking about this in 82 is really interesting. I love this thought, this story again. This is a very great Hawkwind style story of being bored in paradise. It's again got that great dissonance between what you expect and what is occurring. With that lyric about talking dogs, you'd have thought maybe a land of talking dogs might be something you'd never get bored of. But clearly, even that isn't interesting.
Well, perhaps they don't have much to say.
Which is exactly the passage from the book, The Knife of Never Letting Go. Have you read that?
No.
Oh, that's hilarious, because there's a line in the book, The Knife of Never Letting Go, which is by Patrick Ness, which says, the first thing you find out when your dog learns to talk is that dogs ain't got much to say, which is an amazing thing. So maybe, unfortunately, utopian talking dogs are really boring because they're just running around going like, hungry, hungry again, scratch please. And you're like, I wanted to have a conversation. They're like, what? No, feed me. Damn it. So yeah, maybe the talking dogs was the last straw in a utopian dream. I think that's a great idea. And, you know, it's given us lots to talk about, which is fantastic. It's what I always look for and love when I hear a new Hawkwind track like this that we can do. But I also think the music works to raise this from good track to great track level for me. My personal highlight is when the solo comes in after the chorus, halfway through the solo, there's a key change, which is immensely satisfying. Every time that hits, I'm just like, yes, that's exactly what I wanted. And I feel like the solos throughout this whole album are really deftly done. They're a bit 80s-y, but not over 80s-y. They have that howling, screaming aspect to them, but they have a sparseness to them, which never overshadows the rest of the music. I really feel like whoever's playing guitar is able to pick out keynotes, which then layer on top rather than completely overshadow. You know, it's not like someone who's just doing mad finger picking to show off. That guitar is always there to just add this extra layer and point of interest, and it does a really great job of moving the whole thing along. Also, in terms of sound design and ear candy, there's this amazing spectral metallic scraping sound after the solo, which sounds amazing. It sounds like someone like running a knife over a dish or something. This kind of like shoo, kind of sound, which if you just put that over like a 90s drum and bass sample, you'd have a track. You know, I think there's something really glorious to that. I don't know how they've achieved that sound. But again, for me, that's that experimental sound and ear candy, which just adds to the interest of the track. to just criticize a little bit of it. I feel like the breakdown to just the drum kit at the end takes the energy away a little bit, and then bringing everything back in, it doesn't quite hit in the same way that I think they thought it would. It just feels like, oh yeah, now we've just brought everything back in rather than like, you know, explode back. But, you know, we're still good and we go round the verse one more time and then we're done. It's a short, snappy, very sophisticated little track. I really, really like this one.
It hits on so many levels. You're absolutely right. Dave's double-tracked vocal, you don't hear that kind of vocal effect very often in Hawkwind, but it works beautifully here. And the lyric, again, it's Moorcock's other lyric after Choose Your Masks, really well thought out. And it's Hugh Lloyd Langton on the guitar. And this is my favorite Hugh Lloyd Langton guitar solo by some way. I mean, he's an excellent guitarist. He's brilliant in Hawkwind, but this, you're right. He can play a lot of notes per second. He can do the Van Halen. But he doesn't do it very often. He'll do it to punctuate something, but then he'll go back to just laying the notes in that feel right to carry the song. And Hugh's guitar solo in this is not a space left for Hugh to show off, which I think is the case with a lot of guitarists and a lot of guitar solos, particularly in the 1980s. So yeah, this is a beautiful track, and what a run of three tracks this is to open any album.
Okay, so I've got a chance to catch up now. That's another four, and I've landed on a chance square. So let me take a card. It reads, if you are the needle gun piece, entwine your life with another player.
Well, I guess we picked our pieces wisely then.
We did. The needle gun piece is a very unsettling object with the strange legs and everything, but it did have a great song made about it on Chronicle of the Black Sword.
And we get a track which has its lovers and its haters, Matt. We have Needle, 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 Needle Gun.
Or Kings of Speed. This is Kings of Speed Revisited, I believe. And revisited in a really fun way.
Yeah, because we weren't fans of Kings of Speed.
Exactly, we weren't. And I think, again, the recording of it, the speed of it, the fact it was a bit just meh compared to the album it was on, it certainly wasn't doing itself any favours. Because it's on this album, this has some mid-70s exuberance to it, which the other tracks don't, which actually massively endears it to me in ways where Kings of Speed never would. I have a lot of fun with this. It just reminds me how much I like the 70s over the 80s still, despite everything. For me, that sense of kind of like playfulness, but also just a solid groove through it is really nice. So yeah, I think it's good. I think there's either a lot or nothing to say about this track in a way.
It's not a complex track.
No, exactly. But it also still kind of is in a way. And this is that slightly like deceptive thing where the first time I listened to it, I thought, oh, yeah, that's a fun little like silly throwaway track. But more I listen to it, and I think where it is in the album even, I think it's actually quite intelligently put together. Its lyrics flip between enough detail to paint a picture, but again, not enough detail to not allow me to imagine a scenario where these lyrics make sense to me. So I can imagine this needle gun. Weirdly for me, I was thinking it was almost like a needle machine gun. There's that lyric about feel my needles tattoo your spine. I felt that must mean you shoot someone with a lot of needles. Like the end of Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, where that lady has that blowpipe that can fire like 1,000 needles. And I felt like it was something more like that than something insipid and small. But, you know, that's the beauty of imagination and what you can do when the lyrics give you something to play with, but don't tell you exactly what to think, which is, you know, one of Hawkwind's core strengths.
Indeed. I do love this track and always have done. I love the riff. It immediately makes me happy hearing those opening chords of this riff. And then the whole thing's just very bouncy and fun. I love the lyrics, with the exception of the line, it's a vaccination joy with the ultimate death toy. Because again, they really speed to get ultimate death toy in there. You kind of get death toy.
Yeah, I feel like that was just because the lyrics are delivered in that slightly overperforming way again, where you feel like they're having fun. It's almost punky, the way that they're slurring their speech a bit.
Yeah.
It's a vaccination joy with the ultimate death toy. If you hit it out from a syllable point of view, it nails it. But if you're going to then deliver it in a punky way, then yeah, it sounds sloppy. I think there is intelligence to the arrangement. They just then don't show it off by being loose with it.
No, that's totally fair. But aside from that, it's probably my favourite track
And it's such a simple one, not overcomplicated, doesn't have huge breakdown in it or anything. It's just a riff that I find really, really catchy. And choruses and verses, which are really easy to sing.
There's so much fun in the post-chorus instrumentation again, like the solos are really fun. And they do that everyone hits on the beat thing again, which bridges the post-lyrical blocks, exactly what they did on the Song of Swords, which again is just very satisfying. And that's what this track is. This track is just satisfying. For me, it's very difficult to hate it just because everything it does is all for the sake of happy and exuberance. And I think to critique it would be trying to hold it to a standard, which it's not trying to hold itself to. It's just like, no, we're a fun track. And just enjoy it. And like you said, bounce around, which I definitely do. And leave with a grin on your face, please. For me, it's great fun. No notes.
Absolutely.
Wouldn't change anything. The fact they even squeak in Evil Needle Gun at the very end is always really satisfying. Just in case you didn't realize it was. They're like, no, this is not a good needle gun.
That's about right. Yeah. So yeah, let's leave that there. We both like it. So everyone else is just going to have to put up with that one.
Okay, I'm awake again after my time in Utopia, and the free festival is in sight. One good roll should do it. Not quite. That's landed me on this cool spacey square that says, you feel the wind of time blowing. Move 5 spares relative to your current dimension. Well, I'll assume that just means go forward 5 squares, and that's as good as any link to remind ourselves about our pick from Live Chronicles. Master of the Universe is an interesting one, though. I have to confess, I absolutely love this version of Master of the Universe. I can play it over and over and over and over. But it's almost a different song entirely to the original version. Me saying I love this version is not that I think it's better. They're just two completely different things. But this version of Master of the Universe is kind of peak this particular sound of Hawkwind as a band, and definitely peak Dave Brock patented choppy guitar sound.
I would agree. I think this, for me, is one of the pivotal pieces in the entire album from a detailed listening point of view for me. I find if you detailed listen a live album, it tends to change the feeling because, you know, it's live. And so you can pick out mistakes or things that maybe shouldn't have been there. And I've actually enjoyed this album much more when I've been doing something else while it's been on. But Master of the Universe, I do really like listening to because it feels a bit like when they did the 10th anniversary of Silver Machine, where they took a track, actually paid attention to what would it sound like if we made it now and mess with it in positive ways. And I think the 80sification of this track isn't bad. I didn't mind the 80sification version of Silver Machine, but I thought it was a good attempt. I know some people hate it, but I feel like this version of it as well, it's got a solo on it now, which keeps it feeling fresh. I thought the original version was a bit muddy and mumbly and not particularly engaging. I think the speed and the intensity actually really helps the spirit of this. There is also, I feel like, some stereo width coming at the very end of the track as well, which is really nice. So yeah, this for me feels like that kind of Silver Machine-y, taking something and really polishing it up, compared to something like Angels of Death, where I feel like they've just gone, well, what if we played this twice as fast as it needs to be? And then that seems to be all they've done. Master of the Universe feels much more considered. Rocky Paths, I think if any track was going to make sense played at the increased speed and intensity, it was going to be this track, because I already said when we listened to it, this felt like an almost proto-US punk track, and speeding it up only makes it more so. But because this was already fast, they left a lot of space between the notes. So when you speed this up more, it still feels considered and still feels together, where I feel like, you know, if you push a more complex track and make it faster, for me, you don't make it more intense. If anything, you just make it more busy. But because this one was quite sparse anyway, compressing it a bit, it's nice. And it's a shame that they couldn't get that zippy synth overlay that I really like in the original. But as a jump around piece, I think it's nicely done and it's well executed. I think Pulse and Cavern got a much better live rendition than Shaygay did. I think Shake Gate's fine, but this feels good because they've got that KV, for me, like train tracks at 11 p.m. vibe, and I'm sure that must have sounded great in the room. It's a lovely way of bringing down the energy for a moment and getting a bit competitive and vibey. And it's a shame that they were able to get that thumping sound, but not the depth charge for Sea King. But either way, I think Pulsing Cavern is almost shot for shot the studio version, and they absolutely nail that. Okay, so looking at the board, if I roll a 6, then another 6, then a 4, I can use that time portal square to slide sideways all the way to the end and snatch victory from you, Andy. So here goes. It's a 1. Great. And my square says, presciently, disastrous dice roll detected, go back to the war you survived. I'm not even sure that's on this board, but it was on the Xenon Codex to finish off the decade in spectacular fashion.
And we open with The War I Survived. This is one of the ones with lyrics by Roger Neville Neal. And in Ian Abraham's acclaimed book, Sonic Assassins, by the way, Ian suggested that he had a little uplift in sales following our podcast. So it's nice to know, although we are definitely a financially losing organization, we can make a few bob for someone. In that book, which you should all rush out and buy, Ian writes this. For the album opener, Dave Brock selected The War I Survived, a lyric that Roger had based on Kurt Vonnegut's novel, Slaughterhouse-Five. Roger says, I was thinking back to the days when Calvert would select a book for inspiration. I listened to his music a lot, getting into his words and wit. So, although we know that a few months later we lost Robert Calvert, it's actually nice to know that there's a bit of Robert Calvert inspiration going on here, just even in the selection of the Kurt Vonnegut book as the inspiration for these lyrics.
Yeah, for sure. It's great to know that his legacy and techniques live on. The fact he inspired other artists and creators, which, you know, if you are an artist and creator, that is one of the highest honors, isn't it? When someone ever quotes you as an inspiration, that's always amazing. I think because I'd listened to Chronicles so much, I actually didn't get it and I was a bit nonplussed with it. Actually, I listened to this track and then I didn't listen to the rest of the album because I knew I wasn't ready. So I actually took a couple of days, listened to other stuff to try to cleanse my brain of everything that we had talked about before. I guess probably having the live album and the studio album back to back was so thick, I needed to really like clear that mental air. But when I listened to it again, as fresh as I could, I felt like this was Hawkwind in a way reintroducing the things that I like about them. You know, we have this frantic 5 minutes where we kind of learn again what Hawkwind's about. You know, we have sci-fi references with the Slaughterhouse-Five reference. We have war references with the whole War I Survived thing. We have existential human crisis references with the wanting to return to a never-ending war. We have cool bits of the 80s reference with big guitar solos. We have synthy references with cool atmospherics in the bass line. And we have Hawkwind annoying me references with the fade out just as soon as the song sounds like it's going to go into a cool B section. But all of this for me is like, cool, this is everything we put on the shelf as we worked with this other concept that we were playing with. Now we've taken this off, dusted it off, added some of this hard rock energy that we've still got in our veins, and now we're going to see what our other stuff feels like through this filter. So this to me is a really interesting track, actually, with a lot to unpack at quite a breakneck speed. But I think they do it probably in the right amount of intensity that I can still get it. And if you're going to talk about something like Slaughterhouse-Five, which I haven't read in a few years, but I always remember it being a pretty crazy story. So, you know, to decide that you're going to take that on is ambitious, but it's the kind of thing that I can see Hawkwind doing, and they did, so that's great. I like the fact that they open with this ominous clock ticking in this cool stereo effect. It's a great way of coming in cold with an interesting thing to, you know, wake your ears up. I wondered if that was some kind of sonic tag for the idea of time travel, considering they're going back to the war they survived. And I was trying to figure out which war they might be referencing, if they're referencing a real war or whether or not, you know, it's just a concept of a war. But Slaughterhouse-Five is about kind of World War II. And I thought actually when I was listening to this before I read the lyrics, they say the generals cry more, but I thought they said the Germans cry more. The lyrics on the internet says it's generals, but also 10% of the lyrics are written as unknown or indecipherable on the internet for this track. So I don't know whether or not I trust the internet this time. But, you know, given there wasn't a major conflict really going on in the late 80s, I assume they're talking about World War II. I feel like that's Hawkwind's war that they talk about. So for me personally, I'm assuming it's that. But anyway, it's a very difficult song to unpack lyrically, I think. You know, we could probably spend the whole podcast unpacking the line, "I can't live no more, this is Slaughterhouse-Five," you know, given how complex that story is. And again, I haven't read it recently, but I've read it several times. It's an amazing piece of writing. My guess would be that seeing as the main theme of that book is largely about the inevitability of death and the differences between the concept of war on a large scale on your brain versus the much less justifiable inflicting of pain and suffering on a personal one-to-one level, that the song is kind of unpacking the dissonance of being the survivor in an environment designed to kill you, and maybe like the guilt and turmoil that can kind of cause you to go to the point where you feel like by surviving you're somehow doing something wrong. You get that kind of survivor's guilt, that idea about returning to a war you survived in a way that's like a heroic thing, but also if everyone else is dying, then it's a strange feeling, you know. So I feel like there's something very huge and crazy in that, and the idea to want to go back to it makes you kind of wonder like where you are in order for that to be the place that you want to go to. So for me, it's a real Hawkwind brain melter that manages to blend upbeat musicality with deeply disturbing themes of an existential crisis in a way that I feel like really only they do. I don't really see other people even trying to, but they, you know, they'll always take a swing at it, sometimes for better or worse, but I think this time for the better. I've definitely said in previous podcasts that I've heard a track that's made me think Hawkwind are back. And after the last few albums, which I've enjoyed parts of, but felt like some pieces have been missing, this opener, I feel like a man who was lost in a desert that's just had his first mouthful of lush oasis water or something. You know, I really do enjoy all the elements of this coming together. Musically, I think the track starts off with that cool intro with the clocks and this kind of like TIE fighter screaming sound effect. And then this extended drum fill, which just makes just feel like, okay, we're still keeping that high energy. And then this lyrical barrage is like thick and fast and does a good job of really carrying the track, because, you know, the guitar's doing these more longer extended chords that provide more of a backing, you know, before they come in to take care of the post-chorus section. So there's a nice call and response between the vocals having a go and then the guitars going my go and then back and forth, which I think is really nice. Goes back to that thing I was saying where like Hawkwind can arrange now in a way which I shouldn't be surprised with, but sometimes still when I listen to it, I'm like, oh, that's nicely done, guys, good job. And the lyrics come thick and fast, a bit like in Live's Chronicles. The speed at which they're delivered though means that their profundity is lessened a little bit when you're actually experiencing them. Like I had to read the lyrics to make sure I was getting it all. The fact that at least 10% of this whole lyric sheet is quote unquote unfound or unknown, which means that probably the delivery is not quite as strong as it could be. But the repeat listening makes you feel like you get into that. I don't think that's necessarily a criticism, because I'm not against, you know, doing some of the work myself and trying to figure out what they mean. But also at the same time, you have something like High Rise, which is able to do all the heavy lifting itself and allow you to just witness it. It's a creative choice, which I found a little surprising, maybe. But I think it works fine. I was just a little surprised given the chewiness of the whole subject matter. It's quite relentless in what it does. And I like the fact it keeps you guessing. It's got all these lyrics which are taking you on this very strange journey. It's always coming back to this theme of the crisis, but also musically, we occasionally like drop into halftime towards the middle of the track, which gives us this moment to like pause and bathe in some of these cool sound effects noises, which again feel very Hawkwind before we're brought back up to speed again. So they're always keeping you guessing, always keeping you on your toes. The two big drum fills in the track also make it feel like Hawkwind are making it clear that they're doubling down on some live drumming over drum machines, which is a move that I applaud for them. I just think it sounds better when they have that. The second big fill they do with the bass hitting this kind of like 1-2-1-2 note thing, almost this kind of marching feel, is also very satisfying. So this is them being able to blend a complex idea with a track which can also throw you around a dance floor. Which brings me to how saddening it is that the track doesn't end, but fades in that way that I always find unsatisfying, especially when we've just had this big fill, which builds to a bit of a lame payoff, which is a shame because it does sound like it's going to go into this new section. But to quote the great Slaughterhouse-Five book, so it goes.
So it goes. That's well said. And yeah, I must admit, coming to this, I really enjoyed The War I Survived. Again, as I say, much more so than I did when I first heard it back in the day. I like the fact that it's musically quite simple. Most of The War I Survived happens on a single note. The lyric is just all pounding away, but without changing note. For me, it's a little bit like rap to a certain degree, where for a long time, I didn't really care what the words were, because the sound of the syllables and the consonants hitting the meter just sounds kind of joyful in your head. There isn't a lyric sheet with the album itself on the vinyl. When I did look it up and I came across the big five question marks in the middle of a line, I thought how you'd be, if you did this as karaoke, you'd be completely sold down the river, wouldn't you? You'd be on stage. And you'd be, before you continue. But there are some wonderful lines in there. You know, the line, a bulletproof Bible can protect your heart. It'll cover your eyes when you're falling apart. You just grin when this comes up. And given how heavy the subject matter of the book is, the song is actually really quite a joyful experience, if you know what I mean, from that point of view. So, yeah, so I really like this. It feels like a real statement of intent. You know, that riff sounds like Hawkwind, basically, in a way that only Hawkwind can. So it was only fairly recently that I really looked into the lyrics. I knew that it was Slaughterhouse 5. That bit you can really take from the lyrics. But it wasn't a book I'm anywhere near as familiar with as you are. Although I know a fair bit about it. It's not one that I've read in a very, very long time. But yeah, a really excellent start to the album. And good job, Roger, picking that as the subject matter for the track. So I'm one square away from the Free Festival, and you're stuck in an unending battle somewhere in time. Let's call it a draw.
I'm fine with that. We should pack this up anyway and start working on season three. And we hope that all of you have had a great season two with us and that you'll join us on the journey through the 90s very soon. You've been listening to Hawk Binge. It was devised and presented by Andy Hood and Matt Longstaff. The soundtrack was produced by Don Music Presents. To contact the show, drop us a message on Instagram, Facebook or Twitter by searching at Hawk Binge, or send an email to podcast@hawkbinge.space. Hawk Binge is part of the Deep Dive Podcast Network. To find more great band-focused podcasts like this one, head to @deepdivepodnet on Twitter and dive in. Thank you as always for listening. We'll see you next time.
And that's a wrap.
And well, that done. Was the shortest recording we've ever needed
Yay!
To do.
Outstanding. I like scripts. I see a role for ChatGPT in our futures.
Oh, God, can you imagine?
I'm going to stop.